Welcome to Listen In. I'm Brian Gahan, and this podcast focuses on the stories that are buried deep inside all conversations. Be it the kind of conversation you have with someone whose life experience is full of interesting POVs and insights, or the kind of conversation you have inside your own head around your own life experiences. Today in episode 18, I'm talking with author, environmental activist, urban guerrilla gardener, and native plant expert, Lorraine Johnson. Lorraine's passion has led her to a place of reflection on how we interact with urban spaces, on what defines a native plant, and the importance of questioning convention. Her gentle spirit encourages what we do matters, and when it comes to our garden spaces, we can do something very important in the simplest of ways. Hello, Lorraine. Welcome to Listen In.
Hi.
I really wanted to start by talking to you a little bit about the concept of sort of reinventing the sort of urban garden, you know, because I think that that's something that comes up for me that you are doing.
Yeah, that's a kind of great description in a way, or like a really great way to kind of summarize. I've often struggled with what is the connection between all these different things I'm involved with, but I think, yeah, reinventing what it means to garden, why we garden, how we garden, for me, all those things are really important. Mm-hmm. And I guess another sort of key aspect to it for me is that for the longest time, I think gardening has been about aesthetics, mm-hmm. and that maybe that's what draws a lot of people in. It isn't, in fact, what drew me in, strangely enough. We can talk about it if you want. I came to gardening in a kind of circuitous route, but I think for a lot of people, you know, the aesthetics is kind of the appeal. And what I'm trying to do in my work is to talk about and really motivate and encourage people to think about all the ways that our gardens can also be places of incredible meaning and beyond aesthetics, and how to create places of beauty, but places of beauty that are also doing things in the world, mm-hmm. like connecting with the world, and whether that's, you know, creating places of positive environmental impact rather than negative environmental impact, or creating places of social justice, or, you know, however it is that those gardens, and it could be all of those things, mm-hmm. But really to think of the garden not just in terms of aesthetics and beauty, and even if those are the things that draw a lot of people in the first place, but moving beyond that and connecting with the world.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of it kind of like some of the other aspects of our lives that are now interwoven with just, let's say, not the functionality of something like a car. Mm. Oh, I want it fast. I want it pretty or sexy or whatever. Now it's like, is it good for the environment? Are there other aspects of it that start to become equal in the decision making? And I think that's a good point about gardening. You know, I think the majority of people will say, first and foremost, it's about the aesthetic aspect. Mm-hmm. And now, and that's why I say reinventing the garden, and, you know, you're helping people understand the garden does multiple things, and you should think about those as you develop a backyard garden or a balcony or whatever you're doing, even in an urban environment. How do you give back? Mm-hmm. Through the choices that you make. And so that's what I find so fascinating when I've listened to some of your talks, and I've perused through some of your books, and I've felt like it opened my eyes to, oh, it can still look really beautiful. it's just doing so much more than that flower or shrub or tree that came in from some other part of the world.
Yeah. And, you know, our choices can be choices that, you know, do these other things, but they can also, I think another aspect about gardening that has sort of concerned me is that for so long, okay, so the emphasis on aesthetics is one aspect of it, but then also a kind of disregard for the impact on the planet in so many other ways, you know? Oh, you know, who cares about the long-term impact of, you know, these chemicals I'm using or these, you know, plants that I'm introducing into my backyard that might be invasive and it really impact on natural areas. Like there, I think for a long time, not only were those connections to the world not made and in the sense of what the garden could do in a kind of positive, healing, you know, constructive, productive way, but then even the kind of downside of some of the like long-standing gardening practices were just ignored.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the dark side.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't, I think there's, and it's encouraging to me, there's a lot more of an awareness now. There's less resistance. I mean, when I first started, you know, writing about this stuff and engaging with this, the world of gardens and landscape about, it's getting on for 30 years ago now. And at the beginning, there was huge resistance to, and it was treated sort of like, oh, this is just a trend. This is just a phase you're going through to, you know, worry about pesticides and don't you worry the, you know, the scientists are, or the government is telling us it's all okay. You'll get over it, dear, when you grow up. You know, it was sort of that attitude.
You, and idealistic youth, right?
Although 30 years ago, I was not young. But it really has, I think it's changed quite a bit. There's, you know, there's more of a, it's been a slow and steady evolution.
Yeah. And that's why I'm fascinated to talk with you about that evolution, because you've been through it. You've been very much active and involved through it. And it is an area that, you know, that whole, you know, think globally, act locally. And it's sort of like, yes, you can think globally about the environment, but the choices you're making in your own backyard are just as important as the other things that you're doing. And that's going to bring up another subject matter that I'm going to ask you in a bit, but I wanted to just take a step back and just sort of, let's go back to, you know, how did you get into sort of, how many books have you written?
I added it up the other day for another reason. And, I think if you include the books that I initiated and edited that are collections of essays, but that, I was behind them, it's either, I think it was 12 or it might've been 14. I can't remember. Anyway.
Wow. It's enough. not enough, but I mean, it's enough to establish you as an expert in this field. And I love one of the titles of your book, What to Plant Where, because I thought that was so just to the point.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to know that in today's world, you know, what should I be doing? And in listening to some of your talks, I didn't even know that there's even like local native insects and things like that, that rely on the native plants. So I wanted to ask you, what is a native plant? Like, how do you, I mean, I know, but I'm just thinking if there are people listening who aren't sure what that means, what does that mean?
Yeah. And you know, we're really talking together at a moment that for me is a time of kind of expand, what I hope, or it is definitely a time of expanded learning for me, and awareness and understanding and going and sort of that's leading in really rich and new directions for me. So I'm actually in the midst of really rethinking the definition of native plants that I have certainly been a part of putting out there into the world, certainly in Canada, you know, and saying, hey, so for a long time, talked about native plants as plants that existed in an area prior to European settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And because I've been on this journey, a personal journey since the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report came out, and really trying to build relationship and trying to, as a non-Indigenous person, to try to think about, you know, my treaty responsibilities, you know, all of these things, and really build relationship with Indigenous people and peoples. And then to think about what it is I do in my own practice, you know, because the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, the calls to action, you know, asked, called on everyone, and particularly on non-Indigenous people, to think about how these issues connect with their work. So I write about landscape, I write about garden. So that really, that reflection, you know, that period of thinking, wow, I write about native plants and I have never connected with Indigenous knowledge keepers or read books written by Indigenous people about native plants. Anyway, so thinking about this, I realized, okay, the thing about the definition of native plants that myself and others have used forever, a native plant is a plant that exists in an area prior to European settlement.
Because it's about us.
Yeah.
Like it's always about, it's there's before us and after us.
Exactly. And it completely negates, ignores, erases Indigenous agency on the land prior. So first of all, one, I really would not, I wouldn't use that word settlement. I would say, you know, if in any, you know, talking about it, I would say, you know, at minimum prior to colonization or prior to invasion. But then also like how to have a definition that incorporates or acknowledges the incredible land management that was happening here in North America prior to colonization, prior to contact, prior to invasion, however you want to phrase it. So I'm really thinking about that definition of native plants. And I guess where I'm at right now with it provisionally is really the idea, and just in strict kind of botanical or biological terms, I think a useful way to think of native plants is as plants that have over a really evolutionary or kind of planetary time scale developed relationships with every other being or creature or aspect, feature of whatever place you're exploring, and that includes the peoples.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was a very long answer. It used to be a super simple answer to that question for me. It was a plant that existed here prior, you know. Anyway, there are problems with the definition, I do realize, no matter what. But basically, I think ecologically, the idea that they're plants that have developed these complex relationships and adaptations and are part of a very complex web of relationships that, like, we don't understand, we don't know, you know, there's a lot going on. And so anyway, that's how I would kind of thinking about native plants now.
Well, that's great. And you're not the first sort of expert or person I've talked to where I think I have a really simple question and they'll say to me, well, I've been rethinking that lately, and I'll go like, okay, here we go. But no, that's really touching that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had such an impact on one, that you listened to it and took it in, because I don't think a lot of Canadians did take it in on that level of how is my work affecting. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really powerful statement. I remember when it all came out, and then the CBC started to abbreviate it to the TRC or something. And I'm like, no, the name says it all. If you start to abbreviate it to an acronym, it takes it away. And so they kind of stopped. So I don't know if they kind of came to that conclusion on their own, but it happened for a brief while there. And it was really heartbreaking when I would hear it, because I like, you're missing the point. But anyways, that's just my opinion.
Well, and then also the idea that there's been so much talk, I guess, on the kind of reconciliation end of things, and let's name that need for truth and acknowledging truth too, and really like put that at the forefront of all that we do in this place.
Welcome back. I'm talking with author, urban gardening, and native plant expert Lorraine Johnson, who's sharing the importance of encouraging people that their gardens can be places of incredible meaning while still being aesthetically beautiful. So, would you say you're self-taught? Yeah, big smile. Yes.
Yeah. I did not study anything to do with botany or biology or the sciences at all. I actually studied literary studies, so basically theory and criticism in university. And so it was definitely self, I wouldn't call it self-taught either, in that when I started getting involved with environmental issues and realized that what really resonated most deeply for me had to do anything to do with the land and nurturing the land and cultivation and growing things. So the whole gamut, you know, this agriculture or, you know, everything to do with that relationship. So I started joining nonprofit organizations, actually, and getting very involved with a number of organizations. And so I feel like I learned from the people involved with those organizations. Mm-hmm. Groups like, it used to be called the Canadian Wildflower Society, then transitioned to the North American Native Plant Society. But there have just been incredible botanists and very knowledgeable plant people involved with that organization over the years. And they were my first plant teachers in mm-hmm. many ways.
Wow. So if you were to, let's say, give somebody advice, they live in a small urban home with a small backyard and a small front yard, what would be the one thing that you'd say they should do or where they should start? Because it is a bit of, you know, with the Latin names, you can just go into a rabbit hole when it comes to gardening, right?
Yes. Well, I think the place to start actually is maybe with a thought. And that thought that I think can really help guide, especially someone who's a little nervous about it or is not a gardener, who really doesn't know where to start. What you do matters. And what you do, you can do something that is really good and really important in the simplest of ways. And I know I've found that really inspiring in my life and my efforts. And I think it's really true around growing some native plants, whether it's just, you know, add one or two to your existing garden. And what I always warn people about is that you will get hooked like there. But those plants will matter. They'll matter to the soil. They'll matter to the insects. They'll matter to the passerby who sees them and says, oh, that's a plant I don't often see in mm-hmm. a garden around here. I wonder what that is. I mean, so you don't have to start big. You can start small. You can start with just one plant on your balcony in a pot. I really think that once you start, you do get into it. Yeah. So that's a good place to start, starting small. I also think it's good to, and maybe this is just because that's the way I came to it, to search out others who can give you some guidance or help join groups. I really think that this is another way, I guess, I'm trying to rethink the garden. We often, I know there's a tradition of thinking of the garden as a very solitary place. For me, it has actually been an incredibly social place. It's been the place where I meet people, like garden through gardening.
Right.
It's the place of community. And maybe that's because for a long time, you know, I've been involved with community gardening. So gardening in these social spaces and creating gardens with other people to be a shared space for where anyone can join. So I often really try to encourage people to find a community of gardeners who can inspire you and help you and share seeds and knowledge and information with. And we're very lucky in that I think across Canada, there are these events called Seedy Saturdays, and they're in the spring, and they're community events where gardeners come together and share seeds. Their workshops are really grassroots, and that's a great place to find community, a great place to really start if you're, you know, a bit uncertain, unsure. Mm-hmm. It's a very inspiring community, these Seedy Saturdays.
That sounds so cool. Yeah, no, that sounds great, because I think that that's the other challenge is just, you know, once you want to make a difference or do something that matters, you're then so afraid you're not going to do it properly.
Right? Oh my goodness. And I think that applies to so many things for sure. And I guess with maybe with gardening, I mean, in a lot of the things that we do, you know, is there a wrong way to do it? Like, I would say a wrong way would be a kind of short-term chemical fix without a wrong way, if you want to put it that way, whatever. A way that's, you know, just really not going to take anyone to a good place is if you think short-term and you don't think of the garden as a system. But, you know, the what's going to happen is it just might not flourish. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are some, I guess, things that could have more harm. So let's say as a gardener, you're actually introducing an invasive plant that is like a non-native invasive plant that's going to affect natural areas, like spread out, that could be a negative practice. Or, you know, chemical inputs that have an impact on our water, groundwater, et cetera, that could have a negative influence. But for the most part, you know, the quote unquote mistakes that you make just might lead to, hey, things not working out the way you wanted them to work out. And that's a chance to learn more and try again and figure it out and talk to people. Why didn't it work? What did I do wrong? Yeah. You know, more this community building that can happen around gardens.
Yeah. One of the things that when we moved into our house 15 years ago, I think, my wife, through chatting with people like the Seedy Saturday kind of people, found out that in Ontario, or maybe it was just in the city of Toronto, but they would come and do an assessment of your yard and they would actually give you the plants. And so we got a bunch of small trees and different types of, you know, pollinator kind of friendly things free from the city. And we had a gentleman, I don't know what his title would have been, but he came to our house and he gave us the advice on plant this here and plant that there. And it was, I don't think anybody even knew.
Yeah. When I think about how our cities in particular could be transformed by more things like that, exactly the sort of thing you're talking about. And when I think about what a missed opportunity there is, because we as in, you know, our governments, our cities, we spend a fortune on really expensive, complex solutions to problems that could actually be handled so much better at a landscape, like at a local landscape level. I'm thinking of things like flooding and in cities, and there are many across Canada that have these combined sewers, so that when there's a storm and the sewers overflow, it means sewage goes into the closest water body. Well, some cities are spending billions on engineered solutions to these problems. Like, for example, Toronto is building this huge tunnel to store the water. Well, what if, at billions. So what if instead we had hired people who need jobs and have so much to offer, who could go around and teach people about rain gardens?
Right.
And so that every you know, residence, where whether it's an apartment building, a single family home, you know, a senior's residence, you know, every place where a community, social housing, every place where people lived, were landscaped to retain the water on the landscape and have it filter down into the groundwater and do what water does in a healthy landscape, instead of flowing on our hard surfaces into the storm
drains and into the sewer drain. And I mean, I know that because when they overflow like that, and they're dumping the raw sewage, the untreated raw sewage, into the lake, I think they just dump a bunch of chemicals in with it or something too, in order to kind of help curb the problem. So again, like they're putting the raw sewage, untreated sewage in, but they're also throwing all these chemicals in because it's seen as a bit of an emergency. And I think that's a great, you know, I mean, when you say a rain garden, you're meaning what you just described, that your yard absorbs the water that your home produces off of it when it rains.
Yeah, and there's actually, you know, there are great resources online. And there are different things to call the garden, that type of garden, but rain garden seems to have taken off. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's exactly the idea. They can be sort of made in a low depression area on the grounds, on the landscape, or you can dig down a little and put in gravel to encourage infiltration, and then some soil and plants that are adapted to seasonal flooding like that. Mm-hmm. And there are quite a few, and their rain gardens are most commonly, and I think most sensibly, planted with native plants that are adapted to that kind of seasonal flooding and can take, you know, the seasonal flooding as in, you know, oh, it rained a lot.
Yeah, in a minute.
And so all of the water, like from the downspouts, et cetera, is directed towards, away from the house and towards that low area, and where the plants kind of slow it down and it infiltrates into the ground. Mm-hmm. It's such a sensible way.
Well, and
No, I was just going to say, such a sensible way to deal. Like, it's based, I think so much of what we have to do in our gardens in every way is look to natural models. Like, what the answers are out there, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And it just puts another shout out to, or at least it helped me envision kind of the native plant, you know, because, you know, I grew up in Vancouver, where I grew up in Lynn Valley, which it rains. I think it's the third rainiest place in the world or something like that. I can't remember, but it rains all the time. But it would rain for weeks at a time. Like, it would just literally, like, you'd go to bed, get up, it's raining, come home, it's raining, go to sleep, it's raining. And then in Ontario here, when I moved here, I was fascinated how in the summertime, for example, you know, it can be scorching hot and dry, and then a thunderstorm comes through, dumps a ton of water on the ground, and a half an hour later, it's sunny again, and it stopped raining. And so there's plants have to be able to deal with that, right? The change of, well, I get water and I get a ton of it, and then I get none of it for a while. And I think that would be so important, because if you're bringing a plant that's not native, or it comes from a climate, you know, like England, where it's kind of drizzling all the time and it's getting a nice steady stream of water, it wouldn't do so well here. And then it's going to require fertilizers and pesticides and other things that we use as an excuse to say that's why it's not growing properly, when in fact it's just not meant to be here.
That's right. And the, you know, I've noticed in a kind of, let's say, traditional gardening world, the exotic, the so-called exotic, is really prized. You know, the plant that has to be coddled, the plant that takes such work to grow, and those are, you know, like, the, for the most part, kind of the introduced plants that aren't adapted to, you know, the weather, the climate, the other creatures that might want to eat it, etc. And so maybe there's something in the whole, well, traditionally anyway, in the gardening enterprise, there's been something about, you know, the valuing the exotic at the expense of the familiar and the local, mm-hmm. and the adapted. And, you know, I think it's a hugely missed opportunity. I suspect that it's connected with some, with all kinds of things that are, you know, are not actually that healthy or positive.
Welcome back. I'm talking with author, urban gardening, and native plant expert, Lorraine Johnson, who's talking about the ecological cost to shaming and bylaw bullying that has turned North America's urban landscape into a monospecies of non-native grass.
You know, like, I think it was basically corporations that that fed us this lawn message.
Mm. Yeah. I remember the 70s, the amount of work. And then you had, you know, the neighbor shaming where, like, what do you mean you didn't aerate your lawn this year? And we used to use these rakes that you pull the dead grass out with that nobody does anymore. But in the 70s, if you didn't do it, your neighbors frowned on you, right?
And when you think of the ecological cost of that shaming and that, that, you know, corporate message of you have to have a green lawn that's a monoculture of one species of non-native grass, and you have to go to the incredible chemical lengths and maintenance lengths and all of this trouble to grow this ground cover, and why? Mm-hmm. Like, what about some alternatives? And like, we know, when you think about all that we know about monoculture and monoculture being so unhealthy ecologically, all biological systems are based on biodiversity, mm-hmm. and biodiversity leads to health and resilience, like everything. And so what have we done? We've turned the North American landscape as much as possible into a single species,
yeah.
of grass. And, you know, I'm, you know, I think the ecological cost has been huge. It's changing in that I think, you know, there's so much more of an awareness around the, you know, the need to stop using pesticides, et cetera. But there are all kinds of, you know, I guess there are, you know, there's still municipal bylaws all over the place, and people who are gardening in a different way, especially with native plants, or trying to naturalize their yards or bring back a little bit of wild, what might be called wildness in right. the city. Those people are subject to fines and incredible harassment, I would say, like sanctioned harassment by the powers that be, or just kind of neighborhood shaming. Oh. And I think that impulse to control how other people express themselves in their landscapes, especially when it's, they're expressing like a nurturing impulse, I think we really have to examine where that comes from,
yeah.
and why people are so, why cities, why governments, why there's a strong tradition of rejecting any alternative expression mm-hmm. in the landscape.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I was thinking about this the other day while I was getting ready to talk with you, and I thought, you know, how far are we away from an educated society who cares and knows enough about, one, the environmental and the environmental impact of gardening choices, that we get, like, you know, we are now with the Hummer, where you see a guy drive or a woman drive a Hummer and you think they don't care about the environment, or you see somebody taking plastic bags at a grocery store and you think, well, they don't seem to care. Like, you know, can that script be flipped to the point where, you know, if you are putting down, you know, like, or, you know, like that, where you start to feel embarrassed because of your gardening choices, because it shows that you're either uneducated or you don't care.
Well, I know that there are a lot of people, myself included, who would like to see the paradigm shift happen, and that flip that you talk about, so that, and I don't mean that in terms of people being shamed for having lawn. I guess I mean it more that it would be unusual to have like a lawn and only lawn,
right?
Like in a whole neighborhood, that a whole neighborhood would, where every single yard would be all lawn. I would love to see that shift and completely reverse, so that, you know, the kind of near nature that surrounds us where we live would be places of, you know, restored habitat. And if for whatever reason someone or a family wanted some kind of ground cover to you know, run around on, and grass is really good for that, then sure, have a section of something, some ground cover, whether it's turf grass or, you know, something else, but turf grass is pretty good at that, but have a small area to actually use in that way for, you know, games, mm-hmm. or, you know, sunbathing, I don't know, whatever people do on lawns, I don't know. And then, but the majority of our near nature experiences in our cities would actually be places of habitat and ecological functioning, mm-hmm. and that would mean, you know, pretty much native plants.
Right.
Yeah. Although, again, like, I'm not, I don't want to shame people, or like,
yeah,
you know,
I think
plants?
Shame was the wrong word. I didn't mean to say shame.
Yeah. I know what you meant. Yeah.
I meant more just where you just feel a little bit self-conscious. Oh. So it's not that people are looking at you, even though I worded it that way. sorry to all the Hummer drivers out there, but anyways, I didn't mean to shame you. But yeah, like where it just becomes the sort of norm where, you know what, you really just have to, you know, if you want to be seen as somebody who's making a difference, then, you know, you're going to do some things a little bit differently. Cause I think of those suburbs where there's just, you know, as you say, you drive down the street and everybody's yard is grass.
Yeah. I would just really, I'm a big proponent of just really questioning and thinking about deeply, well, any choice that you make in, mm-hmm. in your landscape. So, you know, and that will lead you to a good place. Mm-hmm. If you think about it deeply like that. And so let's say you think about it deeply and it takes you to a place of, you know what, I don't have time to garden. So what should I do? Well, that might lead you to all of the community groups there are out there who are trying to match people who have land they can't look after with people who want to look after land.
Mm-hmm.
So there are just so many new and good solutions, mm-hmm. and ways that we could interact with the places that are around us,
yeah.
that make, you know, can only lead to good things if mm-hmm. we think about it, if we mm-hmm. think about it. And I think we get into trouble when we don't think about it and we just do the automatic thing that, I don't know, we see advertised on TV or, you know, whatever we feel shamed into doing, like, well, everybody's got this, you know, so-called perfect lawn, which is actually, it's weird we call it perfect because it's super unhealthy and vulnerable and takes a lot of work.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, and in Ontario, when we have the dry, hot summers and it all turns brown and people have to water it because, God forbid, they have a brown lawn.
Yeah.
But it's like, well, because it goes dry and that's what happens.
Yeah.
What can somebody, I mean, we don't have anything in our backyard because, when we moved into our house, it was very shaded by a lot of trees. A number of those trees have fallen down or come down because they've gotten diseased or they're old. But there's still a number of trees. And so we were never able to grow anything like grass, which was, you know, something that was kind of there when we moved in. And so we, you know, we churned it all up. And so we just left it go wild. Mm. And at first it was mostly clover. Well, we didn't start with it. It just was there, kind of sprung up. And then what my wife started to do with all the, and I didn't even know she was doing this, but she said, yeah, the seeds you get from the real estate agents, every spring they'll bring you around like a little packet of native seeds or whatever. And she goes, I just kind of like throw them out into the yard. Like I just like, and I let nature decide where they end up and how they end up and what happens. But over time, we've gotten all of these really beautiful flowering plants that come up, and when the backyard gets way too full, that you can't walk through it, I'll have to go and I'll cut it down and then it'll grow up again. So twice a year, once a year, I cut down the backyard, usually in the middle of the summer, and then it grows back again. And then in the winter or in the fall, it just all dies and collapses and whatever. But over time, it's become very, very beautiful and very kind of natural, but we still get that odd, you know, people come over to the house or the neighbors look over the fence and they're like, what's going on here?
I'm hoping that we start to shift our idea of what is beautiful and we start to rethink aesthetics so that something like what you're describing, which to me sounds really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's, I'm sure, a lot of life in what you're describing.
Yeah.
There must be a lot of activity that like life force encouraged and nurtured in what you're describing. And I hope that we can somehow move to a valuing of that as beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So value function as a kind of, you know, beauty and aesthetic value. I really hope we get there.
It is. I mean, our front yard has a lot of wildflowers. It has some echinacea in there and it's fascinating, the bees.
Yeah.
Like you'll just like, you'll come out of the house sometime and you'll stop and you'll look and it's not a big front yard. It's, you know, it's probably like, you know, 20 by 20 kind of thing. And there'll be, you know, 10 to 30 bees at any given time hovering around these plants. And you're just shocked that, you know, like, cause you don't even see them anywhere else. And then all of a sudden you'll just see them all in your front yard. And it's just so, well, it's just so rewarding. Yeah.
And I think that's what happens with native plants. Basically you, whether you just plant one or you plant a bunch, and then you start to see, it becomes not just some strange theory. Oh yeah, those plants are adapted to the place. And there are all these incredible relationships among all of the creatures in that place, living and non-living features of the place. And it, when you see it literally happening in your front yard, or, you know, or when you walk out the door or at your community garden or at your, you know, where at a school, at your neighborhood school, because schools are doing so much planting and naturalizing. When you see that, wow, those plants really do kind of create these relationships so that the bees are there and the other insects and the vast array of of, you know, flies and beetles and all of these insects that we have been taught as gardeners to think we have to eradicate rather than, wow, we should be encouraging this incredible web of connections, because that equals resilience, biodiversity equals strength. So we shouldn't be getting rid of these so-called bugs. We should be encouraging them. And when you plant the native plants, you're providing the habitat for them. You're nurturing those relationships. And, you know, as you've just described it, you can, you know, walk outside and see it in action. Mm-hmm. You can really see it. And then that's why I think even if you just plant a couple of native plants, you'll get hooked, because once you see that happening, it's like, I love this. And it's kind of snowballs. There's a snowball effect, because I know that for a long time, especially, you know, in the early days of writing about gardening with native plants and talking with gardeners about native plants, there was so much fear and worry around, and understandably, if people have anaphylactic reactions to bees, for example. But then there's also this sort of kind of process to go through of talking about, well, you know what, okay, so it's only certain types of bees that sting. The vast majority of our native bees are solitary. They don't sting. You know, all these sorts of just ways that we can expand our understanding of the world and how it works and who these creatures are and how they interact with each other and what our place is in that whole web. I think native plant gardening is a really good way into all of those questions and issues and really amazing things for people who are interested in gardening.
Welcome back. I'm talking with author, urban gardening, and native plant expert, Lorraine Johnson, who is sharing how she is leveraging the foraging and foodie trends to introduce people to the conversation around edible native plants. I wanted to ask you a bit about sort of edible, because again, I was watching one of your talks and you were talking about sort of the native edible. I think some of them were fruits from trees and things like this. And I thought that that was a very interesting concept, because you were saying about some of them, like, you know, people don't even, well, one, people don't know that they can eat them, but two, no one's even commercialized it. But meanwhile, you would think that they would do just much better in this environment, and therefore they should be able to produce a better crop and et cetera. Where is your thinking around that as this is sort of a question more about, like, you know, what's the future look like for you? and do you see yourself, you know, helping us move into that area? Because, you know, like, as people say with food, you know, we're going to end up eating insects one day because of the shortness of food. And I go, well, you know, I'd rather just learn about some of these edible, you know, trees and plants.
Yes. I'm really interested in edible native plants and I've been talking about it a lot with people, but mainly I think my motivation for doing that is that I'm just always looking for ways to kind of sneakily, I guess, almost like a sneaky way to, you know, meet people where their interest lies and present this idea of native plant gardening wherever they're at. So, you know, I don't know, 15 years ago, everyone was interested in drought tolerant plants or low maintenance plants. So, you know, I talked about native plants in that way because, you know, they are adapted to the conditions. And so if you plant the native plant in the habitat, sort of, if you put the plant in the right place, it's not going to need a lot of supplementary watering and all those things. So right now there's a lot of interest in food and food growing and
foraging.
All that stuff. And so I try to encourage people to I try to discourage a lot of active, certainly digging, definitely not digging up native plants from the wild in anywhere near most cities. The natural areas just could not survive the kind of, you know, growing interest
in the onslaught of the onslaught. The new trend.
Having said that, I think there are definitely inherent rights around indigenous harvesting of plants, but what I tend to focus on for a gardening audience is, hey, you're interested in, you know, growing some of your own food or trying an unusual new plant, or have you thought about, and then introducing them to that gardening audience to the array of really delicious, unusual, edible native plants that they can be growing in their own backyards or community gardens or shared social spaces, community places.
No, that's great. I met you, or I saw you for the first time at the David Suzuki.
Oh, you were there.
But it got me thinking, you know, he's been such a strong sort of focal point of environmental, you know, practices in this country. And who do you see presently as a, maybe in the younger generation that's coming up, or has it diversified to, it's just all of us, you know, that are becoming the advocates for, or the people that are speaking about, have we gotten to that point where it's now diversified down to being like everybody can be an environmental advocate by speaking and talking and doing?
I do think that the kind of environmental activism, awareness, worry, concern, is more broadly based than ever now. And I don't think there are, you know, I think there's a, there's also a, you know, broad array of voices tackling different aspects to a problem that I think is kind of at its core about a really dysfunctional relationship with nature and the earth, and a terrible impulse to control and dominate that at its heart is over, you know, these ideas of, you know, our monetary system and what has value, et cetera. So those are the core issues, I think, that are leading to, and, you know, it has to do with dominating people as well, you know, as we, you know, have seen through this country's colonial the colonialism that is at the heart of Canada, both historically and as expressed, you know, through in the current day in so many of our structures and, you know, institutions. So I do think that there are, I do think that the kind of tackling of those issues is coming from all kinds of different kind of points and points of view, and I think that's a good thing. I think there's diversity in the environmental movement, and in just there's a, and even to say in the environmental movement, there's diversity in the ways that everybody or a lot of people are going at the things that need to change in order for our species to last into the future.
So you've dedicated your life to something that's sort of outside the mainstream. What drives you? How do you keep your passion alive? Is it just that you're seeing this evolution happening before your eyes? Is there, because I mean, it's hard to be outside the mainstream. You've been doing that for a very long time. You're one of the pioneers. And so I'm just curious, what drove you, and also what drives you as you move forward?
Oh, that's a hard question in some ways, because, you know, when it's just the way that you are, it's sort of hard to, I think I know where it comes from in my own life. You know, you've basically described my dad. Outside of the mainstream for sure, very unusual, eccentric, had his own way of doing things, and question things and question convention, and taught me to question convention. So it's just been, you know,
who you
part
are.
Of my DNA from day one, I guess. But I also, and maybe because it's so much a part of, I can't see a downside to questioning convention. And that doesn't mean that we throw out all conventions. Like there are all kinds of conventions that make good sense for all kinds of reasons, but there are all kinds of conventions that don't make any sense and are actually harmful. And let's really question it all. You know, keep the things that do actually help people and help everyone, you know, like help everyone meet their, you know, their needs. But the conventions that are actually only benefiting a few, let's do everything we can to be not only outside of those conventions, but dismantle them. Because the things that are only helping a very few, that's just wrong.
Yeah, no, it's, and I think that we're coming to a phase in our history where that is going to get turned upside down. And I think it's thanks to people like yourself and all the hard work you've done over the years to bring people's awareness to the importance of the choices they make when it comes to gardening. So Lorraine, thank you so much for being on Listen In. But before we go, I just wanted to ask you, how can people get in touch with you if they're interested to learn more?
Oh, well, the best way to get in touch with me is via Facebook. So I'm very, not super active on Facebook, but, you know, I look at it all the time. So I would get any message that anyone sent to me via Facebook, that's fine. I'm a little, I'm old school, so I still haven't, you know, joined Instagram or Twitter, any of those things. It was every year I say that's going to be my project, and I still haven't done it.
Well, it's so funny to go, I'm old school, I have Facebook, which is still a social media, which is not that old. So is it just Lorraine Johnson at Facebook?
I think so.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Well, you know what? If they type in Lorraine Johnson and somebody else comes up, well, if she's not got pictures of gardening on her Facebook yes. page, it's not you.
Yep, you'll find me that way. I used to joke because I was the only Lorraine Johnson in the Toronto phone book who had my phone number listed. So I felt very easy to find that way, very publicly accessible. But now that I am, you know, not exactly on all of the social media platforms that most people are, but Facebook works.
Yeah. Great. So thank you so much for being on Listen In, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for the conversation. I enjoyed it.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's another episode of Listen In. Thanks for being. Please subscribe, leave comments, or head on over to our website at listeninpod.com. That's listen with two N's, pod.com, where you'll find episode notes, links to anything that we talked about in this episode, and you can connect with us about being a guest on Listen In.